So in the last class, we have been dealing with the last three verses of these Upanishads, the 15, 16 and 17. And the last section of the Upanishad deals with the problem of death. Now in the Upanishad philosophy, you find two important features. One, a complete disgust for worldly pleasures or worldly life, and the fear of death. These two very important ideas, you find it in the Upanishad philosophy. Now you have to remember, this is the transcendental philosophy of Vedanta. We should never be under the wrong notion that the Upanishads completely neglect the realities of life in this world. With a view to take a man away from the worldly or empirical plane, to make him understand the importance of going beyond the empirical, beyond the worldly pleasures, it sometimes overemphasizes these two elements. One, a kind of disgust for worldly life, and fear of death. And then it proceeds to give a solution to this problem of death. And it convinces, it tells us that death is only a creative crisis. Death is not an enemy. Death is a natural phase of human evolution. And this conviction is driven home by showing that we are not this body, we are something beyond this body, which perishes at the time of death. Once a man realizes that he is beyond this body, he is the deathless reality, then he transcends death, he goes beyond death. Not that he avoids physical death, but when he realizes that he is something beyond which physically doesn't die, which doesn't die when the body perishes, then he transcends death. This is with regard to the transcendental aspect of Upanishad philosophy. The Upanishad philosophy also has got a realistic aspect. There is a strong element of realism as well. To go beyond this problem of death, to realize that we are the deathless Atman or soul or self, to go beyond that, to go beyond the empirical plane and to realize that supreme truth, we must first of all understand the transitoriness of worldly life. Worldly life, the reality of worldly experience or worldly life is not neglected. The Upanishad says that man needs physical comforts and he needs the instruments and the tools which bring him physical comforts, which are technically called artha and kama. Man needs that. But if man thinks that these two constitute the supreme goal of his existence, then he will not care for any morality, any spiritual or even cultural values. So the Upanishad says that we had to follow the path of, we had to follow the pursuit of worldly desires without deviating from the path of what is called dharma or right or righteous means, ethical or moral values. And if a man pursues the path of worldly pleasures, worldly life, without deviating from these fundamental moral values, then a time comes when he realizes that there is something beyond worldly pleasures. Only if he conducts this pursuit of worldly desires and worldly pleasures without deviating from the path of righteousness, or what is called, technically called, dharma, then he realizes there is something beyond this. And then he looks for something transcendental. In spiritual life, that transcendental value is called moksha, or liberation, or coming out of this wheel of the cycle of life and death and rebirth. Rebirth is also a very important problem in the transcendental philosophy of Upanishads. Everyone prays to be freed from the cycle of life, death, and rebirth. The Upanishad gives a message of fearlessness. The world is not something to be scared of, to be afraid of. Rebirth or life itself is not something to be afraid of. There is something beyond this. And it tells us that when a man realizes he is the Atman, the Supreme Self, which is eternal, he transcends death. But before reaching this conclusion, this Isavasya Upanishad presents a number of other ideas. First of all, in the beginning, it emphasizes the unity of God and the world, and the union of the contemplative and active dimensions of human life. Contemplative life and active life. God and world are reconciled. We cannot lead an exclusively contemplative life without an active element in it. Therefore, what is needed is a reconciliation. This idea is being put by Sri Ramakrishna in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna in a very simple language. The uniqueness of Sri Ramakrishna's teachings is that all these ideas have been put in the language of the common man, and using the similes and imageries of his everyday life. Sri Ramakrishna says, you touch the feet of God with one hand and work with the other hand. That's what Sri Ramakrishna says. Touching the feet of God is the contemplative element of spiritual life. And working with the other hand is the active element of spiritual life. So, in other words, the contemplative and the active aspects of life have been reconciled. And if a man reconciles both, he can live a righteous life in this world, and he can meet the problem of death with courage and wisdom. This idea of death taken as a creative, a positive element in human life is found in the lives of all great men. If you read the life of all these great personalities, one unique aspects of their life, they have been able to face the problem of death with an equanimity of mind, with a tranquility of mind, which normal man cannot even think of. Some of them died just as entering from one room to another room. There is an interesting episode in the lives of Shankaracharya. According to the traditional lives of Shankaracharya, you know, Shankaracharya was supposed to be the incarnation of Lord Shiva. So, along with him, two other divine personalities also took birth. One is the Lord of Wisdom and the Lord of Death. Both of them took birth as his companions. And when Shankaracharya reached the fourth year, his father died. And at the time of death, what happened? This man entered his shrine, the shrine in his home, and then prayed, and then he came out, and then a mysterious old man also came out of the temple. But he didn't realize, he thought he must be the priest of the temple. And he sat and started a conversation, a discussion with Shankaracharya's father, Shiva Guru. And he asked the question, Kim sarvam Krishna pranam kridam nakhila? Means a question that is, have you surrendered all the actions of your life to the Lord? Have you surrendered your whole life and all the actions that you performed in your life to God? Then he says, yes, that's how I was leading my life. That's how he replied. Listening to this, this man entered the temple, the priest, at least he was the priest. That's what his father thought, Shankara's father thought this man was the priest. He looked like the priest. And he entered the temple and vanished. Then he also followed the priest, but there was nobody in the temple except the image of Lord Krishna. So he vanished. Then his father realized, well, my life is now coming to an end. And then he prostrated before the deity, went inside, called his son Shankara, 4 years old boy. And then he lay down, and then just before he breathed his last, he said, Hey Shankara, mrityum mitravat pasye. This is the instruction which his father gave to Shankara. Look upon death as your friend. This instruction. So from that time onward, these two boys also started playing with Shankara, but not visible to others, visible only to himself. This is a story. So the idea is, when a man advances in spiritual life, he realizes that this is not the end of the journey. There is something far beyond this, and he is the one Atman, the reality, which is eternal. And once he understands, he realizes his unity with this eternal Atman or Supreme Self, then he transcends death. He becomes identified with the deathless reality. This is the... Now, in this verse, towards the end of this verse, you can find this. I already just mentioned this loka. Vayuhu anilam amrdam athedam basmantam shariram om kratosmara kritam smara kratosmara kritam smara. I have already dealt with this verse, but I can deal with this once more. So, here, the Upanishad tells this devotee who was leading a virtuous life, who followed the path of truth, unselfishness, and righteousness, who was worshipping Sun as the supreme God, he finds in front of him the Sun, the God whom he was worshipping, standing. He requests him, he prays to him, I am now seeing you in your relative dimension, means with name and form. This name and form are always tempting elements. We are all, actually our senses, our mind are all drawn towards the name and form. So long as a man is satisfied with the name and form, he will be satisfied with the idea of going to heaven. Because heaven is just an extension of man's imagination of worldly life. What we can't get here, we can get in heaven. Maybe whatever pleasure we get we may get, but in a more intense, in a, perhaps in a more limitless way we get. But the moment a man transcends the empirical, the relative, then he starts thinking of something beyond heaven. In fact, Upanishads are the only books which take us beyond the concept of heaven. So here he prays, let my breath be merged in that cosmic energy, power, that's called prana. And I know my body will be reduced to ashes. At the time of death, the devotee requests, he prays to his own mind, please remember your good deeds. As he said in the last class, whatever we remember the time of death decides our next life. Now, according to Vedanta, there is a belief that if a man dies chanting pranava means omkara, om, that's why in mantra ki, om kratosmara, kratam smara, please, oh mind, contemplate on omkara, pranava. If a devotee who is not a jivan mukta, who has not attained liberation, if he dies chanting pranava, mantra, omkara, he will get gradual liberation. He may go to heaven, but again gradually, after crossing different levels of existence, ultimately he will become one with the infinite reality, and then he will come out of this cycle of life and death. That is ultimate goal. See, life as human life, as a worldly life, is something negligible, something which is finite. But this life also becomes an instrument in our hands if we live it properly. If we guide our actions, mental, physical, and intellectual actions properly, then this life becomes a useful instrument. This life can take us beyond the ocean of worldly existence. That's what the Upanishad says. So it says, Vayuhu anilam amrdam mathedam bhasmantam shariram om kradosmara kritam smara kradosmara kritam smara. He asks his own mind to think of whatever actions he had done. I already referred once to a very interesting episode in the Bhagavata Purana, which is one of the most well-known episodes which drive home the implication of this particular verse. In the old Upanishads, you find the relative and also the transcendental dimensions of philosophy. If you take, for example, Katha Upanishad, you find the narration of Nachiketa's early experiences and the two boons which Yama gives to him. Nachiketa first asks for worldly pleasure. If I go to my home, my father should not be angry with me. That's the first boon. The second boon that he asked for was heavenly pleasure. The third boon that he asked was this. Some people say that after death, there is nothing more left out. And according to some other people, there is something beyond death. So, ayam prete vijigitsa manushi asti tyege nayam asti di chayege edad vidya manushishta stoyaham varanamesha varastrutiyeha. This is the, in fact, this verse stands at the turning point of the philosophical evolution in Katha Upanishad. There is the relative and also the absolutistic dimensions, the empirical and the non-empirical, the trans-empirical aspects of philosophy. In Mundaka Upanishad, you find the same. A great householder comes to a sage with the name Ankira, ask him, what is the supreme knowledge by knowing which one can know of everything? In reply to this question, the sage tells him, there are two types of wisdom or learning or knowledge in this world, the relative and absolute. Except the transcendental experience, all other learning, all other types of wisdom are relative. Apara, the other is para. We experience indescribable experience. This trans-empirical consciousness or experience is the only wisdom which is supreme. Again, in the Chandogya Upanishad, there is an interesting episode. A great sage of those days, Narada, who is a well-known figure in Hindu mythology, he himself was a very learned man. He comes to a great sage, a man of wisdom of that time, he's called Sanat Kumara, and tells him, I have learned all the Vedas, everything, Upanishads, all. But still, I feel that there is something yet to be learned. What is that wisdom? Before he started speaking, Sanat Kumara asked the sage Narada, you tell me what all you have learned. So in reply, Narada tells him, well, I have learned Rig Veda, Yajur Veda, Sama Veda, Athar Veda, and all the prevailing branches of learning of that age. Then, after he gave a long list of whatever books he had mastered, then Sanat Kumara, the great teacher, tells him, Nama Eva, all these are words only. So the greatness of Upanishads is this. The Upanishads tell us that there is a much higher learning, a much higher wisdom, which the Upanishads themselves cannot explain or define. And that is the supreme experience. Now, one can reach the supreme experience only by transcending the empirical or the phenomenal. But how to do that? How to go beyond this? For that, one should lead a virtuous life. And if he leads a virtuous life, a life based on righteousness and moral values, spiritual values, even if he had not realized the supreme truth, he will have a higher life in his next life. He can lead a higher life in his next life. And then slowly he can progress till he realizes that he is the eternal supreme consciousness. Yeah, as I said, in the Bhagavata Purana, there is a famous episode. That's what I was trying to refer to. There, the entire Bhagavata Purana is a response, a highly metaphysical response to a question asked to the teacher. The question was, what should a dying man do? That was the question. Because if the problem of death can be solved, the problem of life also can be solved. Man commits all errors, man goes out of his way to achieve worldly pleasures. He commits crimes and he does evil deeds. Just because at the time of doing those things, he thinks that what he is going to achieve by those deeds will bring eternal peace to him at the time of doing. So, but if he realizes that whatever he can achieve in this world are finite, limited things, they cannot bring eternal peace and happiness to him, then he may do many things to achieve them, but he will not go out of his way to achieve those goals. Now here, a great king, his name is Parikshit. Parikshit was a great emperor, but he happened to commit one heinous sin. Just only one. In his whole life, he committed only one heinous sin. One day he went out hunting in the forest. He got tired. He entered a hermitage. Inside, a great sage was meditating. This man was very hungry, very tired, and very thirsty. And he found the sage was still seated, absorbed in meditation. He didn't get up and offer him a seat or offer him drinking water, nothing. So this man, this king, who was otherwise a nice man, noble man, he thought the sage is not showing him proper respect. So I should teach him a lesson. Is he just pretending or is he a genuine sage? Let me see. And he looked around there. He found outside the hermitage, he found the dead body of a snake. He took that, the dead body of the snake, and put it around the neck as a garland, and went away. After some time, this sage's son came to the hermitage, and he found this horrible thing. Somebody had put the corpse of the dead body of a snake around his father's neck. And he was horrified. And the boy himself also was a great man. He himself was he himself was an advanced soul. He had performed many spiritual practices. So he had some divine faculties. And the story tells us that he went to the river, took bath, and then he cursed. The man who committed this heinous sin shall die on the seventh day. So that was the curse. And when the sage opened his eyes, he found the son standing there, and the son told him what he did. And the sage was very unhappy. He was shocked. He said, "What did you do against the king? If the king dies, the whole country will be submerged in anarchy. There will be chaos everywhere. So you did a great wrong by cursing a king. You should not have done it." He sent a messenger to the king. "My son, out of his impertinence or immaturity, cursed you. But his words will never go wrong. If he curses somebody, it will work. Because the son also, the small boy, he had performed many austerities, so he also had acquired many divine powers." How the king received this news, that's the most important subject here. The king suddenly realized that he had committed a heinous crime by insulting a great sage. So he said, "I deserve it." And then he counted 7 into 24. How many hours that meant? He was not frightened. He was not horrified. He said, "Well, this is what I deserve for the wrong which I committed, for the crime which I committed." And he renounced his palace, his kingdom. He crowned his son as the next king and went to the banks of Ganga River Ganges. And he decided to spend the next 7 days in contemplation and meditation on God, sitting on the banks of the Ganga. Hearing this news, all the sages also came to the banks of the Ganga. Because they also were impressed by the wisdom of the king. The king was not angry when he received this terrible news. Rather, he welcomed it as a sign of God's grace. And because that enabled him to spend the next 7 days of his life in complete contemplation on God. If there was no curse, perhaps he would have died an accidental death fighting with his enemies or something like that. But here, because of this curse, he could spend the last days of his life in contemplation and meditation on God. So hearing this news, all the saints and sages of that particular region assembled there. congratulated him, you are an ideal devotee of God. And also, on the next day, another great sage also happened to come there. He was Shuka. Shuka was Shukadeva. Shuka was the son of Vyasa. He was greater than Vyasa, a much more renowned sage than his own father, Vyasa. So it is said, when Shuka came, Parikshit puts two questions to Shuka. The question was this: I am going to put a question to you. What are the questions? What should one hear? What should one chant? What mantra should one chant? How should one perform? How one should meditate? Whom should we contemplate on? And what he should not do? Who? The man who is about to die. What should a dying man do? And what should a dying man not do? This is the question. So, Ata Prachami Samsiddhim Yoginam Paramam Gurum Purusha Seha Yatkarim Mriyamanasya Sarvata. Means, the man who is facing death, whom death is staring at his face, what should he do? Yes, Rotavyam Atho Japyam Yet Kartavyam Nirbhi Prabhu Smartavyam Bhajaniyam Va Bruhi Yadva Viparyayam. So whom one should meditate, whom he should contemplate on, what divine holy names he should chant, and how he should perform his duties and responsibilities. In reply to this, Shuka gives the reply. There's a last clause in this question. Bruhi yadva viparyayam. What one should not do. In fact, if a spiritual aspirant learns this, he can never do anything wrong. Because every moment when we do something wrong, we believe the world is real. A criminal commits a crime, thinking at least for a split moment that that deed will give him something in the form of contentment, happiness, joy, or whatever it is. A man steals money. Though he may have read books, he may know that money is certainly not eternal. Still, at the time of doing, that split second, he comes under a powerful delusion that money will bring everything. Otherwise, he won't commit that crime. Now, you may ask the question, if there are many enlightened, well-educated criminals, they know perfectly well that money won't bring them everything. It is true, but at the time of committing the crime, they forget it. That is what is called the power of Maya. Because, as I said some days back in that Vivekananda Hall, somebody puts his question. Swamiji, Swami Vivekananda's definition of Maya, Maya is a statement of fact. So, a mother brings up the child with all care, affection, and attachment, all that. But a child becomes a renegade. He becomes ungrateful. Still, the mother remains too attached to the child to realize the folly of continuing that kind of blind attachment. Still, it becomes a kind of golden shackle, chain, which she cannot break. She knows that it is absolutely ridiculous, but she can't do it. And the problem is, we are under the delusion, not because we are intellectually unaware of it. Everyone knows, most people know many things about spiritual values, religious values, but still cannot practice them. To say that people are not aware of it, that they are in need of intellectual information, is wrong. Most people in the modern world know that money cannot bring everything. Even if you need not be religious, you need not believe in God to realize that money will not bring everything. Any intelligent man. But still people go out of their way to procure money. And that is what is called the power of Maya. So intellectual information is not the solution to this problem. So Shuka first takes up the latter part of the question put by Parikshit. Bruhi yadva viparyayam, what one should not do if he wants to face the problem of death without fear, if he wants to face death as a friend, say, just as Shankaracharya's father instructed the son, mrityum mitravat pasyed, means you should look upon death as your friend. So Shuka says, what really happens to people who are under the strong delusion that the world is real, money is real, and worldly pleasures can bring eternal happiness? They commit all kinds of crimes and sins, and then they die a miserable death. They are reborn, and again they relive a miserable life, and again they are dead, and again this cycle continues. This is the fate of people who do not realize the folly of looking upon the world as eternal, as worldly pleasures as eternal. Then he says, then takes up the other verse. Now, what should be one's goal? This can be practiced by a child who is going to live for 100 years, and also a 100-year-old man who is going to die in a day or two. Both type of people. A child who is going to live for 100 years can practice this philosophy of life, and also a 100-year-old man who is going to die the next day can also practice. So Shuka gives the answer. Etavan sankhi yogabhyam sudharma parinishthaya janma labha parapumsam ante narayana smriti. I shall explain in English. He says, ante narayana smriti means remembering God when we breathe our last. That's what it actually means. If one can remember God, or if one can remember something auspicious, that is the supreme goal of human existence. This can be achieved by many means. Just look around, see everything, see how people live. If you read newspapers, San Francisco Chronicle, or any newspaper you read, any book you read, anything, if you look around, you can see the world is certainly not eternal. Any right-thinking man can do. That's what Buddha did. Buddha was a 28-year-old young prince who was married, had one child, was brought up in luxury without any knowledge of the problems of the world, miseries of the world. And one day it happened as a coincidence. In fact, his father didn't allow him to come out because an astrologer had predicted this man is going to be the emperor. Emperor is spiritual empire. That's what astrologer meant. So the thing possibly feared that this boy is going to be a mendicant, a monk who will renounce the king and palace, everything, which the father didn't like. So he was brought up in exclusive luxury without any knowledge of the world outside. But one day, anyhow, he was being taken along the street in a chariot, and he found somebody taking a dead body to the cremation ground. Then he found an old man who wrinkled, can't walk properly. And then he found a sick man, and then he found a saint also. But one speciality of the face of the saint was that he was perfectly calm and quiet. In all other people, he found a miserable face. So he wanted to find out the truth behind it. He left everything and he became Buddha. So if one, I don't mean that everyone should become a Buddha or can become a Buddha. That's not what I mean. But any rational man can become a Vedantin. If he looks around and analyzes the life that he meets around him. Oh, that is Sankhya, or Yoga Abhyam. Oh, one can practice purity of mind. One can, that is Ashtanga Yoga. It's a little more complicated. Or through Karma Yoga. Whatever you have to do, whatever duty or responsibility you have to perform, you perform as an offering to God. Every act becomes a worship of God. So, if we don't practice this, even worship becomes a God work. The ideal is to turn every act into an act of worship. Then every moment becomes meditation. The whole world becomes a temple. And that's how one can lead a spiritual life. That's what Swami Vivekananda called the spiritualization of the totality of human existence. That's a term which Swami used. Spiritualization of the totality of human existence. So, Sudharma Paridishthaya, these are three methods which Shuka prescribes. If you do that, any of these means, or any life you live, see, whatever work one is doing, business, in teaching or farming or any work, whatever may be. If one can look upon oneself as an instrument in the hands of God and his work as an act of worship of God, then his whole life becomes spiritualized. And then, inevitably, his last thought will be centered around God. So, Antena Irana, this is the supreme goal of human existence. And this is how a man should lead his life. And this is possible. This should be possible. This should be the ideal for a 1-year-old child who is going to live for 100 years, as well as for a 100-year-old man who is going to die the next day. That's why the Upanishad says, Om Kradosmara Kridamsmara. Remember your past deeds. Your mind, turn back, look back, and remember your auspicious deeds, your virtuous deeds. So that, thinking of these deeds, I can breathe my last and I can have a higher existence in my next life. The devotee, perhaps, is not, in this context, is not looking for ultimate realization. Remember, these Upanishads, you know, you have to remember, the Upanishads do not consider a single compact book. It contains different levels of metaphysical, spiritual ideas. So in this context, in this particular verse, we can find a devotee who has led a good moral life and who is about to die, just expressing his desire to think of the good things he has done so that he can have a higher life in the next. This is. The last verse comes 18th. Agnenaya Supataraye Asman Vishwani Deva Vayunani Vidwan Yodhyasmat Jukuranameno Bhuishtham Te Nama Uktim Vithema. You know, Agni, fire god is an important figure in Vedic literature. In fact, the first verse in Rigveda, which is the oldest of Hindu scriptures, begins with a prayer glorifying Agni or fire. Agni mele puro yudham yajnasya deva murticham kotaram ratnadhatamam. This is the first verse in the Rigveda mantra. So Agni is an important figure in Upanishadic and Vedic philosophy. So here this devotee prays to Agni. Hey Agni, please take me to a higher region and please lead me by a proper path. That's called, I already explained earlier, Uttarayana Marga, the path of the divine, the path of gods, which will ultimately take you to higher and higher levels of existence, finally culminating in the unity of the eternal consciousness, an experience which breaks the chain of life and death, the cycle. So, in the last verse, the devotee prays to the fire god, Agni, please lead me by that auspicious path so that I won't have to return to this world again. You know all my deeds. So he also prays, if at all I have done something wrong, please destroy all my evil deeds. Please refine and purify my mind, and I salute you again and again with this prayer. This is how the Upanishad comes to an end. And Om Purnamidha Purnamidham Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Avasishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. I think I suggested in last class that you may ask any question, any doubts, full clarification. We have still about half an hour. I can spend that time for clarifying whatever doubts you may have. So then the next Friday I can start another Upanishads. We have already come to the end of this Upanishads, 3 months. Yes. Yes. Now, Atman and Brahman, these are the two terms that we normally use. Atman implies the immanent reality which is the indweller in this body-mind complex. It is the immanent reality, the inner essence. The same reality is called Brahman when it is looked upon as the origin of this universe and also the sustaining principle behind the universe and the point of dissolution of the universe. The Upanishads and Gita tell us that this essence, this consciousness, takes this body only as a vehicle, as an instrument through which to manifest. See, if a man dies, perhaps his senses are intact, his body is intact, he's very healthy, still he dies. It happens. Somehow it happens. Now, what is that which leaves his body, which turns his body into a lifeless entity? What leaves him? What was present in him which made him, which enabled him to walk, to think, to act? Something which is invisible, something which is distinct and different from the body. So this reality is the Atman, the formless reality. And remember, this reality can be known only through the medium of experience, as our own immanent reality. It can only be experienced. That's what the Upanishads say. If you ask the question, what is the Atman? We can say, Atman is not a name of that reality. That Atman, the reality has no name at all. But philosophy has to use a term. Every metaphysical, philosophical work has to use certain vocabulary. So, Atman and Brahman are the terms used to explain the inexplicable, to describe the indescribable, to name something which cannot have a name at all. And this reality can only be experienced. That's why if you look at the pictures of saints and sages, they don't stare at something, Because they are not looking towards a God who is sitting somewhere above. But the idea is there in Hindu religion also. In Upanishads also you find references to God with name and form, etc., attributes, etc. But the highest idea of the supreme reality is a reality which is the immanent reality, which is omnipresent, immanent, and also transcendent, everlasting. So that's why a sage, when he meditates, if you look at Buddha's picture, that's we can very easily understand. Your Jesus Christ picture also, yoga posture, fine. He's not looking at anything. He's not looking at anything. In fact, he is looking at himself. He's turning inward. You may ask the question, is the Atman sitting inside the body? Yes, body is not Atman. But without the presence of the Atman, body cannot have any function. It cannot function. It cannot work. Atman doesn't walk, but you cannot walk without the presence of that consciousness within you. That is the reality. So, it is distinct from body, mind, and everything that we can think of. That's the highest concept of God according to Vedanta. Now, Vedanta, in Vedanta, mind you, they do not reject other ideas, non-Advaitic ideas of God. They only insist that that's not the whole picture. There is something beyond this. That's all. It depends upon man's own evolution. As you evolve further and further, your own understanding, your own concept of God also grows. A primitive man thinks God creates this world. If I go on a particular day to a temple and worship and give him some money or some offering, he'll be very happy. That's the primitive man's concept of God. And as man evolves further and further, spiritually, his own idea of God evolves, grows. Ultimately, he realizes that reality is immanent, the indweller in everything. It is transcendent. It is also omnipresent. Purusha, yes. Yes.
Can have various meanings according to context and the person interpreting it.
Yes.
A few classes ago, we talked about Purusha as the indweller inside the puti, inside this body.
Yes, yes.
But it's not this body.
Yes.
Could you talk a little bit about Purusha as that cosmic Purushottama, as that
Yes. Now, Shankaracharya gives two definitions to the word Purusha. One is Purishete iti purushaha. The idea is this. Pura means this body-mind complex. That purusha sits or exists in this body-mind complex. Which means that purusha is distinct and different from this body-mind complex. Unless you are different from a room, you cannot sit in a room. Unless you are different from the chair, you cannot be sitting on the chair. So that Purusha indwells in everything. That's one definition. That implies the immanent aspect of the Supreme Reality. Then, Purnatvat Purushaka, that's another term, means the Purusha is complete, completeness itself. The omnipresent nature, the all-pervading nature of the Supreme Reality is implied here. It is everywhere. So it is immanent, it is omnipresent. It is also transcendent. So the Purusha Sukta, Atyadishthat Deshangulam, the particular Rigveda mantra, means it transcends also. Now, in its relation to the cosmos, let us say, Purusha transcends all time. Purusha transcends the very concept of time. That's what is implied in the Bhagavad Gita. Uttama Purushastu Anneha Paramatma Iti Udakritaha Yo Lokatrayam Avishya Vibhakti Aviveya Ishwaraha. Then, so that Purushottama is stated here as the one supreme reality which envelops, which covers all the conscious and also unconscious entities in the world. It is the Brahman, the supreme reality itself, the all-pervading, the immanent, and the transcendental reality. So that's why I sometimes made this point clear. In the Bhagavata Purana, this can be made very clear by citing one point mentioned in the Bhagavata Purana. This most important Purana, of course. It describes Krishna as the complete Lord. Means Krishnastu Bhagavan Swayam. Means Purna. Means Sri Krishna represents the ultimate, the final, the complete aspect of Godhead. Now, some of the commentators explain this. The commentators say, see, Krishna never laughed, never cried, never wept, never doubted, never thought much. He was neither sad nor happy. You never find any expression in Krishna's face except a mild, not very expressive smile, a half-suppressed smile. That's the expression Krishna's face. Now, commentator says, here Krishna presents the full picture of Purusha because as the immanent, omnipresent and transcendental reality, Krishna sees everything. When there is an unhappy experience, he is not sad because he knows that this unhappy experience will come to an end because he can see the future also. This unhappiness will come to an end. So why should he be sad? Because he can see the future. Because the entire experience, human experience, is revealed. Time stands still. It's a timeless concept of the ultimate reality. So if there is a happy experience, he is never overjoyed because he knows that that also will come to an end. So if one can represent the entire human experience, that is Purusha. So it is immanent, transcendent, and also omnipresent. Now, in the Vedic literature, there is a serious problem, in the Upanishad literature also. Upanishads and Vedas were written, I don't say they were written, they evolved at a time and in an age where language was not fully developed. Sanskrit language was not fully developed. Philosophy was highly evolved. So when language is inadequate, and the metaphysical or philosophical speculation had reached the zenith of its perfection and evolution, the same words will have to be used to imply different things in different contexts. So that's why one of the commentators of Veda, Yaskas Nirukta, is the first etymological work in Sanskrit language. One of the commentators, Durgacharya, he says, I shall quote the verse and then I should translate in English. So, pravaktuhu vaividhyat prakarana vaividhyacha asya arthasya annena bhavidavyam. These are examples given. And the idea is this. So, many terms are used in the Vedic Upanishad literature. Purusha, akshara, antaryami, mana, indriya, etc. In certain Upanishad mantras, the word sometimes the Purusha is used to mean Atman or Brahman. Very often the word Purusha is used to mean Atman or Brahman. Same term is used. Similarly, the word Atman also is used to mean body, and senses, mind, intellect, and so on. You have to think of an age at least 5000 BC. The Upanishads and Vedas took the written form only around 3000, 4000 BC. But they had already, they were evolving, and it took at least 2-3 million for their evolution. In different places, in different hermitages scattered all over India. So naturally what happened was this. The same term was used in different contexts, denoting different things. So, sometimes the word Atman could mean body, sometimes mind, sometimes individual self, sometimes the cosmic universal self also. Similarly, Purusha was sometimes used to mean human beings. Purusha Sohamasmi in this mantra. Purusha, that's a last mantra if you take, you can understand the in the Upanishad itself. It comes here towards the end. Yes, it comes to the 16th mantra you find here. Tejo yatte rubam kalyanatamam tatte pasyami yosavasu purusha sohamasmi. So, this is a description of the devotee's experience as he gets before him a vision of the Supreme Reality in the form of God, a Supreme Reality manifesting in the form of sun. So, tatte pasyami. He says, in front of me, I can see the Supreme Reality, that auspicious form of yours I can see. And then he says, Purushaka. Purushaka means Aditya Mandalastaha Purushaka. This is a Sanskrit commentary. The reality who is seated in sun and also myself are the same. He is giving a picture of the Advaitic vision. The Supreme Reality which is behind the phenomenon called sun, and the Supreme Reality which is the indweller, the immanent reality within me, are the same. And that means this the individual self and the universal self are the same. This is what is implied here. So here, Purusha means Atman. That is meant here. So, all these terms are highly fluid as they are used. We know the exact meaning in which it is used only from the commentaries of Sri Shankaracharya. In fact, it is Shankaracharya who brought these mantras to this level of philosophical, spiritual speculation. The only effort to interpret Vedic mantras before the advent of Panini, the Greek grammarian, was Yaska, Siddhirupta. Before that, there was a Nikhandu. It's called there was a dictionary was there, but it was not available. It was incorporated into a great book on etymology, Sanskrit etymology, which is written around 8th century BC by a great scholar named Yaska. The book is called Niruktam. Etymological work. There he only attempted to give explanation of some words and terms used in Rigveda mantras. He refers to near less than 400 rigs. Rigveda Samhita contains more than 10,000 mantras, and he refers to just about 400 something. But it was Shankaracharya who turned to this Upanishadic portion of Vedic literature, and actually he built this philosophy into them. That's what he did. If Shankaracharya had not written his commentaries, today we won't be reading Bhagavad Gita or Upanishads. It was he who developed a philosophical superstructure on the basis of the Upanishad literature. So he gives the meaning. From his commentaries we can understand what the particular term means in this particular context. And then meaning becomes very clear, very obvious. So, without studying the commentaries, we may not be able to fully understand the true implications of the terms. But we can, of course, get an idea even from translations. The spiritual aspect we can get very easily. The metaphysical or the philosophical aspects becomes clear when you read the commentaries of Shankaracharya. Yes.
In that class, there you mentioned that the Parinamavadins, that they would never accept the substance, the clay substance as a reality. They will accept the pots or the jars, etc., etc., but they would never accept the clay itself. What is the rationale or the thinking of that particular school?
Yes. The word Parinama and Vivarta, both are two streams of one main philosophical thought current, which is called Satkaryavada. It means the effects already is contained in the cause. If you take the clay on the one hand and pots and pans on the other, and or if you can think of a mud pot or mud vessel standing in front of you, you know very well that this pot was already there in the clay. A new form was given to the clay, and so a new name also was given. Otherwise, the same. So the effect, that is clay, sorry, effect is the pot, and clay is the cause. The effect was already present in the clay. This is called Satkaryavada. Now, this Satkaryavada has got two streams. One is Parinama, the other is Vivarta. Parinama means the theory of transfiguration, the doctrine of transfiguration. According to them, the clay actually becomes the pot. It gets transformed or transfigured into the shape of a pot. Because they accept the reality of name and form. In the form, the name of the pot and the form of the pot. But Advaitins say, this name and form are just superimpositions. After all, what's the distinction between a heap of clay on the one hand and a pot which is made out of it? The heap of clay plus name and form is what is called a pot. And if you break the pot, the form vanishes. Then you don't call it a pot anymore. So name also vanishes. Then goes back to clay. So before the pot, before the clay was turned into pot, it was clay. When it stands in front of you, then also it is clay, because name and form are not eternal. And then when it's broken, then also it is clay. Here you have to remember the Vedantic concept of ultimate reality or Vedantic concept of anything that is true. Anything which remains without any change in the past, in the present and future is called real. If you want to use the word real, then it should satisfy three conditions. It should remain the same in the past, and it should remain the same in the present, and it should be the same in the future. So, Trishukaleshu yat na vyabhijarati tadeva satyam. This is a definition given by Shankaracharya. I mean, in the three dimensions of time, if anything remains unchanging, it is real. If it changes, it is not real. Nama and Rupa, name and form, are not eternal, because before the pot was made, name and form were not there. After it is broken, then also name and form will not be there. So when do they exist? Name and form only when it stands in front of you as a pot. So it is not real. So clay is real, pot is unreal. Because name and form are not real. They are unreal. Now, Parinamavadins, they do not agree this theory, this doctrine. They say the clay actually becomes the pot. They argue that name and form are real. In the sense, they say Brahman becomes the Jagat. Brahman becomes the world. That is, this view, Parinamavada, is followed by the school of Sankhya, the school of Ramanuja, also. And also another school which is called Jnana Karma Samuchyavada Bhartha Prapancha. These three schools accept the doctrine of transfiguration. Advaitins accept Vivarta. Vivarta means this change is there, but change is only apparent. It is change, but it is only apparent change. Because why it's apparent, it is not real, the change is not real. Because when you break the pot, it goes back to clay. When before the pot was made, it was clay. So no distinction. So change was that the clay becomes the pot, but it is not a permanent change, it's only apparent change. That is the Vivartavada. In other words, in Parinama, another example I can give, this is a very famous example, that is a for Parinama, the Parinamavadins give the example of milk becoming curd, or yogurt as you call it. The yogurt perhaps they were not familiar with. Curd they call it. The tea is called. Now, your yogurt cannot go back. The curds cannot go back to milk. So this is the example they give to Parinamavada. This is how the Brahman becomes the Jagat. But Vedantins do not argue that. They say it is like clay becoming pot, not like milk becoming curds or yogurt. So two examples. So in other words, according to Parinamavadins, both belong to the same level of reality. Because milk is a vyavaharika satta, according to Vedantins, the relative reality. And yogurt also is a relative reality. Curds also relative reality. But according to Vivartavadins, it is not that. The Rajju is Vyavaharika reality. And what is called the rope is a Vyavaharika reality. And the snake is only Pradibhasya reality, it is pure imagination, just appearance. I shall give the example. Advaitins always take the example of Riju Sarpa Bhranti. If there is a room which is not well lighted, semi dark, you see an object lying there, a piece of rope. If you look at the rope, suppose there are four people in that room, four people have four interpretations of that object they are seeing. One man may say, well, it looks like a snake because he had seen a snake somewhere else that day. And the piece of rope lying in front of him in the semi-dark room resembles a snake. Another man would say, well, it looks like a stick if that rope is straight, lying straight as a straight object in a straight line, then it may look like a stick. And they would say it looks like a crack on the floor. It's called Bhutchidra, it is called. Or another man say, it looks like a thin stream of water. Water flowing like a thin stream. That if the room is dark, a pitch dark, you won't see anything. And if it is fully effulgent, fully lighted, you will not have any mistake. But if it is semi-dark and you are not sure what the object is, then you may have four different interpretations. These are examples. These examples, remember, they were all written at least 3,000 years back. So you cannot have modern examples. So now, this rope is in fact a relative reality. All other as are imaginations. When you open the window or you bring light, you understand it is only a piece of rope. This is an example given by Vedantins. In other words, in Vivarta, both belong to two levels of reality. Two levels of reality. In other words, the snake is just fictitious, just a manifestation, or just you just think that way when there is not enough light. But when you bring light, you can see the rope in front of you. That is a relative reality. And the absolute reality is only Brahman. That cannot be brought into this example. That's the idea. Parinamavada is accepted by the school of Ramanuja and also by the Sankhyas and another fringe group of Vedantins. They were not pure Advaitins. They were a fringe group. It's called Brahma Parinamavada of Bhartru Prapancha school. Vivarta is accepted by Advaitins. Yes.
Yes,
yes. That's why Ramanuja says that Brahman itself, Brahman is transformed this Jiva and Jagat. Jagat means the world, the phenomenal world. It is unconscious. It is Achit. And Jivas are conscious entities. And Brahman is the whole, and Jivas, individual souls and world, they constitute parts of that. So, Amsha, 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 Amshi, Sambandha. Brahman is the whole, the rest are parts. That Brahman transforms itself into Jivas and Jagat. This is their theory. So, that's why the great Vedantic scholar, he is a Sarvajnatma Muni, he has written a very well-known book. It is called Samkshepa Sharirakam. It's called, the book says, he says, at the beginning, one may conclude that it is transformation. But when you go deeper, see, if you ask a child, well, what do you think of the difference between the clay and the pot? On the one side, on one side you have pots and pans and different utensils made of clay. On another side, you have heaps of clay. If a child won't agree with you, if you say both are the same, he says this clay has become this. It's true. But you ask the child to break it, it goes back to clay. Oh, then he says, after all, it was clay only. So, Vedantins say, Vivartavadasya Purvabhumi Vedantavade Parinamavadaha Vyavasthidesmin Parinamavade Soyam Samayadi Vartavada. Famous dialectical work by Sarvajnatma Muni. The name of the book is Samkshepa Sharirakam. It's a very famous statement. He says, Parinama is the first understanding, first reading of Vivarta. First you think it's a real transformation. But if you go deeper, then you understand that it is transformation, but it is only apparent transformation. So apparent transformation is Vivarta, real transformation is Parinama. So it is not real, that's what Vedanti, Advaitins say. It is only apparent. So, Parinama or Doctrine of Transfiguration is the first reading or earlier reading, earlier understanding. The idea that this transformation was only apparent transformation is a later understanding. That's the idea. No more questions. So, now, the next class, you may bring a well-known book, Mandukya Upanishad, which may, you find that book tells about you, whatever you are seeing, experiencing every day, that's what Upanishads, that particular Upanishad deals with. Deals with our own experience in waking state, in dream state, and in deep sleep state. it takes you closer to Vedanta. So Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat Sri Ram.